Jeff Custer, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The political repercussions of intensifying violence in the wider region would be immense, compounding the many crises besetting the Horn of Africa.
That was Rosemary DiCarlo, UN Undersecretary General for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs, on concerns about the impact of Ethiopia's conflict spreading to other countries in the region. Details coming up. Also, despite a court order to restore Sudan's internet service, the country still remains largely offline. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The African Union and the United States say they see a small window of opportunity to end fighting in Ethiopia as the United Nations warned of the humanitarian and political repercussions if the conflict escalates.
What is certain is that the risk of Ethiopia descending into a widening civil war is only too real. That would bring about a humanitarian catastrophe and consume the future of such an important country. The political repercussions of intensifying violence in the wider region would be immense, compounding the many crises besetting the Horn of Africa.
That was Rosemary DiCarlo, UN Undersecretary General for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs, addressing the UN Security Council yesterday. Speaking from Ethiopia, the African Union envoy for the Horn of Africa, former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, said that by the end of the week, we hope to have a program in hand that will indicate how the two sides can achieve humanitarian access and a withdrawal of troops that satisfies all the parties. The United Nations estimates 400,000 people in the northern region of Tigray are living in famine-like conditions following a year of war. Reports say ethnic Tigrayans are being forced into military service and that dozens of priests, monks, deacons and others have been detained in the capital because of their ethnicity.
It is emboldened to a level it threatens to unseat a popularly elected federal government and destabilize a nation of 112 million people. We again reiterate our plea for the support of this group that have been providing it with communication equipment, satellite information, weapons, and even fighters to desist from this. It is not only illegal, but also an immoral act.
Taye Askesilase Made, permanent representative of Ethiopia to the UN, said the rebel Tigray People's Liberation Front is sacrificing people on a hopeless journey. The UN Security Council is urging all sides in Ethiopia's spreading conflict to stop hostilities and create conditions to start a comprehensive national dialogue and ensure full and safe humanitarian access. The Tigray Liberation Front claims to control several strategic cities in the Amhara region and that its fighters are hundreds of kilometers from the capital Addis Ababa. The U.S. envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, presented a roadmap to end the crisis, including a ceasefire, withdrawal of forces, delivery of humanitarian aid, and the immediate start of unconditional dialogue. Joseph Siegel, director of research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi challenges and prospects for a ceasefire.
I think there are still strong incentives for both sides to reach a ceasefire, given the uncertainties of what would happen if the TPLF advanced the Addis. There is value on both sides to trying to reach a negotiated settlement beforehand. I think it's very hard to visualize at this point because the attitude and emotions have become so polarized on each side. Moreover, there are some very fundamental structural questions and principles at play about what a federal Ethiopia is going to look like, or what it should look like, for however flawed and critical one could be about Ethiopian government's response to the Tigray crisis. Under the government of Prime Minister Abiy, you know, they have undertaken numerous reforms that have opened up more democratic space and protection for civil liberties, and have really been promoting a vision of a unified federal Ethiopian state. So I think there's a strong sense of wanting to defend that on the part of the Ethiopian government. The TPLF initially was focused on defending Tigrayan interest over time, and as it has had some military success, I think its objectives have expanded, and now it is looking at it can reshape the federal structure for the government, and perhaps even dismantling the system so that each of the individual regional states has far more autonomy.
The challenge facing Addis Ababa escalated with the announcement of 9 factions on Friday forming a new alliance to overthrow Abiy Ahmed's government under the name the United Front and the Ethiopian Federal and Confederation Forces. Would such an alliance complicate the conflict?
I think it does. It's certainly an important development, and it helps us to see more clearly where the TPLF is going with its advances. Many analysts have doubted that the TPLF would actually try to move on Addis, given the logistical challenges and its difficulty in governing a massive country like Ethiopia with 110 million people. The expectation has been that the TPLF was making these advances so as that it could strengthen its negotiating position. However, the formation of this alliance suggested that TPLF does have broader ambitions, and it is looking to use this coalition of many small parties and armed groups to create some sort of governance structure under which the TPLF could claim, you know, broader representation and perhaps try to govern all of Ethiopia. In this way, it would be trying to reconstitute the EPRDF, the TPLF led and ruled Ethiopia for over 30 years. And, you know, in this way, it may be that the TPLF is seeking to build on its notion of ethnic federalism, and in that way, encouraging breakup of the federal structure of Ethiopia into ethnically based regions, which would provide more autonomy for Tigray within either weak or non-existent federal structure.
In the past few days, the Tigray Liberation Front announced its control of several strategic cities in the Amhara region after it seized all areas of the Tigray region last June. The front confirmed that its fighters are hundreds of kilometers from Addis Ababa, and the Allied Oromo Liberation Army said that the capital could fall within weeks. How feasible is that when tens of thousands of Ethiopians allied in Addis Ababa on Sunday in support of Prime Minister's Abiy Ahmed's government, as federal troops fight rebellious forces who are threatening to march on the city?
Well, the fact that there were these major marches in support of Abiy, I think, is noteworthy, and it underscores that he remains highly popular and representative of majority of Ethiopians. And so this would be a challenge for TPLF if it were to march on Addis. And nonetheless, the TPLF has demonstrated that it has the more organized and experienced fighting force. Let's recall that the TPLF dominated Ethiopian military for the past 30 years, and so it has more experience and more military leaders with the training to lead these forces. Nonetheless, you know, the TPLF would not be welcomed in Addis. So this is a different situation that we saw in 1990, 1991, when they were fighting the Derg, and which was widely despised across Ethiopia. I think in the same way, this coalition is not representative of large segment of Ethiopian population. Even the Oromo Liberation Army doesn't represent a majority of Oromo. So it presents a challenge for the TPLF coalition about just how they would manage a drive on Addis, and then how they would be able to sustain it logistically, given their far-flung nature and the resources that would be required to do so. So I think there are a lot of important questions out there that would need to be considered. Nonetheless, it does add a very different structure and angle to the whole equation, what we're looking at in the Ethiopian conflict today.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed Al-Shanawi. Despite a court order to restore Sudan's internet service, the country still remains largely offline. According to the French news agency AFP, online access has largely been blocked since October 25th, the day Sudan's top general Abdel Fattah al-Burhan dissolved the government, declared a state of emergency, and detained the civilian leadership. In a joint statement today, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International asked Sudan's military leaders to release government officials and end arbitrary arrests of protesters. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports indicates that security forces tear-gassed demonstrators and rounded up more than 100 people last Sunday. The report also says so far at least 14 protesters have been killed since the military takeover. The action taken by Sudan's military leaders has drawn international criticism and has upended the country's fragile planned transition to democratic rule. Germany is the latest developed country to promise money to help South Africa move away from burning coal to generate electricity. Last week, during the COP26 climate change conference in Glasgow, President Cyril Ramaphosa announced he'd secure $8.5 billion from countries, including the United States, to make South Africa a low-carbon economy. The country is the world's 12th biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, mostly because of coal burning. Darren Taylor has more.
Ramaphosa says South Africa's coal-fired power stations will be decommissioned over the next 15 years and transformed into green energy plants. There are 19 major coal fields in the country, producing more than 300 metric tons a year. Coal makes up three-quarters of all minerals extracted in South Africa. The powerful National Union of Mine Workers, the NUM, is very worried about the implications of ending reliance on coal.
We must do it very responsibly, that the transition does not create or increase the current unemployment.
William Mabapa, a senior NUM official, says implementing clean energy could put about 100,000 coal miners out of work. This will add to an unemployment rate of almost 35%, one of the highest in the world. But the CEO of one of South Africa's leading green energy firms, Mohammed Madi, says it's too early for the NUM to panic.
In absolute terms, the number of jobs that will be created from green energy will be more than the current number of jobs in the coal industry. The amount of expenditure, capital expenditure, overall investment, etc., in green energy is going to far outweigh the money that has been spent on coal-fired power plants.
That may be so, says Mabapa, but most of the miners currently employed in the coal industry won't automatically get jobs in the green power sector.
Yes, we hear that there is expectations that there is going to be a lot of jobs. But to our understanding is that these processes of renewable energy, they are high technology areas. So most of the areas, there will not be many people working. Show us how those jobs are going to be done.
Mahdi says no one, not even the NUM or the state electricity company, Eskom, will be able to stop the revolution that's coming.
I was stunned when I heard the CEO of Eskom saying coal is still going to be around for 15 years. I'm not sure where, but certainly not in this country. Decentralization is going to be a key factor that's going to create independent power plants all over the country. Eskom's biggest clients, now they may not yet realize this, but their biggest clients are all going to move to independent power plants. And that means the death knell of coal long before 10 years are up.
But he adds there'll be no need to scrap coal-burning plants completely.
Large portions of them, the steam-generating turbines, those are useful. It is the fuel that is the problem. It is the coal that is feeding those steam turbines that is the problem. What we need to do is find alternative sources of fuel to generate heat, to generate steam, to run those turbines. So those coal-fired power plants can be repurposed, and we need to phase out coal.
Mabapa says it's very concerning that the NUM is getting information about South Africa's green energy plan from people with vested interests, such as Mardi, but nothing from the government.
I don't know whose plan is that, whether it's a private sector plan, whether it's a government sector plan, but whoever the plan is for, that person must call stakeholders that are involved in this sector and then show us this is how we are planning to run the transition. Why are you doing this thing? Why are you doing them in the dark? Why are you hiding them?
Mabapa says climate change is real and green energy is great. But should coal mines be shut, alternative employment must be found for miners. Otherwise, there'll be big trouble. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Botswana signed on to a worldwide commitment at last week's COP26 climate summit to ease the use of coal and move towards cleaner energy sources. However, the country declined to sign a pledge to stop issuing new licenses for coal-fired power generation projects. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokondisi Dube has the details.
Botswana is among 49 countries that signed a pledge to shift away from coal. Though the country did not commit to end issuing new coal licenses, instead the government says it intends to fully utilize its more than 200 billion tons of untapped coal reserves using clean technology. In his State of the Nation address Monday, President Mokgweetsi Masisi said there are a number of state-supported projects underway.
Murupule coal mine, Motheo open pit, and a coal washing plant project aimed at expanding coal production by 1 million tons per year is progressing well. The first washed coal from the project is expected by October 2022. There is also progress at the Minergy coal project at Medea. The construction and commissioning of the coal processing plant is expected to reach full production during the first half of 2022.
Environmentalists regard coal as the largest single contributor to climate change, but President Masisi says Botswana is committed to resolving the problem by turning to cleaner energy sources.
In an effort to continue reducing the effects of climate change, government is rolling out the biogas technology program. This program aims to deliver small-scale digester plants to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 1,650,000 tons of carbon dioxide by 2023.
Speaking after the COP26 summit held in Glasgow, Botswana's Minister of Environment, Natural Resources and Tourism, Phil Dagering, said the country needs financial resources to ensure the use of clean technology to mitigate against climate change.
A lot of funding is targeted for countries that are called least developing countries. And this excludes Botswana because we are not among countries considered to be least developing. We are considered middle-income, developing countries, and we are expecting that the negotiations will actually address this issue so that no African developing countries, you know, will be left behind. We see here a need for African countries and developing countries as a whole to actually fight for inclusion, you know, into accessing climate change funding by fighting together, agreeing and coming together to become a strong voice in advocating for access to climate change funding.
Some of the world's biggest coal-dependent countries such as US, China, Russia, India and Australia did not announce a target date for ending the use of the fossil fuel, while reports China plans to build over 200 gigawatts of new coal power. Supporters of clean coal like the World Coal Association say that millions of people around the world depend on coal as a reliable and resilient source of energy. The global energy research firm IMBAS says that coal today provides nearly 34% of the world's electricity, but others say the technologies for cleaning coal, including those that capture and store carbon dioxide emissions, are expensive and not as clean or effective as wind, solar or water power. Critics say that power plants driven by coal pollute streams and land with wastewater containing poisonous elements like arsenic, selenium and lead. Yet, for Botswana, its plentiful supply of the fossil fuel offers a way for the country to diversify its economy away from its traditional reliance on other products, including diamonds. And for policymakers, coal could remain an important energy source, at least until newer technologies become more affordable. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Haburoni, Botswana.
Militants attacked communities in the Rutshuru territory in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, forcing thousands of people to flee. The DRC army says the attackers were with the M23 militia, although its leaders have denied being involved. Reporter Jafar Al-Katanti in Goma has been covering the story, and he spoke with VOA's Kate Pondawson.
In the night from Sunday to Monday, in Rutshuru territory, armed group attacked the city of Jomba in the mountain of Chanzu and Tamugenga and Runyoni. And the FRDC who were there left the position, and the position was occupied by the enemy up to 11 morning. And then the administrator of Rutshuru with the FRDC counterattacked, and in the evening they controlled again the situation and leave the rebels. But the problem is, who is the rebels? According to the Congolese government and army, it's the M23 group. But late yesterday in the night, the M23 said that it was not them. They denied the responsibility of that attack. But according to locals, the attackers, rebels, came from Rwanda. And as we know, Chanzu and that area was the last zone of occupied by M23 the last time in 2012.
Can you tell me a little bit about who the M23 are? What is their history?
M23 is a group of former Congolese officers of the Tutsi ethnic. In 2012, they made M23. M23 means Movement of the Agreement of 23rd March, which the agreement said that all militia have to surrender to the government and become officers of government. And then they did it. They became officer of government, but just after 5 years they left the government, and now they are rebels. They went in part in Rwanda and another part in Uganda, where they stay till now.
So the army has really gone into that area to try to calm things down.
Yes, the army went a bit late, but they did what they have to do. You know, the problem is that Sunday in the evening, the alert was for Goma. U.S. government alerted their citizen in Goma that Goma could be attacked by the same militia who attacked Bukavu last week. And authorities of DRC protected Goma, sent all troops in the region in Goma to protect Goma, and M23 profits for that to attack and control the zone.
That was journalist Jafar Al-Katanti in the Eastern DRC. He spoke with my colleague Kate Pondawson. Niger begins 3 days of mourning today, honoring at least 25 young children killed when their thatched roof classrooms caught fire, while authorities are looking into a deadly gold mine collapse. Officials say at least 14 others were injured, some seriously, in the school blaze in the southern city of Maradi yesterday. A similar tragedy occurred in April when a fire fueled by high winds swept through an elementary school in the outskirts of Niger's capital Niamey, killing 20 children. Meanwhile, hundreds of people gathered yesterday at a gold mine in the Maradi region a day after 18 people died. The governor of Maradi region, Abubakar Chabu, visited the site, telling the Associated Press that authorities will review how to reorganize this operation and improve conditions. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.